Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, this is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure, sitting in for Jim Flynn. This week, we're taking a look at the increasing turmoil in the Middle East. The group known as the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, has taken control of two of Iraq's major cities and is moving toward the capital. Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations has said he fears that ISIS may begin ethnic cleansing against Shias as the United States and others consider military action. The UN says the situation in Iraq is a severe humanitarian disaster. Today on Global Journalist, we'll look at the rise of ISIS and what's going on in Iraq. We're joined by Sergei Danilushkin, based in Prague, the director of Radio Free Iraq, Mustafa Ajbeli, a journalist based in Dubai who's covering the conflict, and Namo Abdullah, the Washington bureau chief for Kurdish TV station Rudaw, who joins us from Erbil in Kurdistan, Iraq. Welcome, all of you, to Global Journalist.
Hello.
Thanks again for joining us. Exactly, who is ISIS and what is their relationship to some of the Sunni Islamists who fought the U.S. in Fallujah and other Sunni areas of Iraq nearly a decade ago? Sergei, could you just sort of catch us up to speed on who these folks are?
Well, briefly speaking, this is a splinter group of a larger umbrella organization which is known generally as Al-Qaeda. They have a specific agenda. They're a little bit or much more militant than the mother organization. That is why they are having conflict, and it is believed that the fighters for the ISIS came currently to Iraq from Syria, where they're waging war against the regime in that country. Their goal is to establish an Islamic state. It is not a nation state. It is rather a religiously based state. That is why it might seem odd, but it covers parts of the territory of Syria and parts of the territory of Iraq, where the Sunnis are the predominant part of the population.
Mustafa, is it just ISIS alone that has been able to make these gains, or are there other groups involved that are fighting with them?
Well, there are different groups actually fighting now in Iraq, and ISIS is just one of them. But most of the international and regional media attention actually is focused on ISIS. And of course, there is no doubt about it that ISIS is leading the fighting and is the one that actually has sort of like started and made major assaults against the Iraqi forces. But right now, there are several groups from the former members of the Saddam Hussein's army, army officers, and local tribal rebels from different clans in Sunni clans in Iraq. So it's actually several groups that now actually trying to break them apart, so that we can actually understand. A lot of attention now is being focused toward the tribal forces and understanding what they are. There are even last week, it is a group that just emerged that's like more of a Sufi group within the Sunni heartland. And of course, there are different groups, it's not just ISIS.
And Namo Abdullah, I think one thing that people in the United States were surprised by was the rapidity with which the Iraqi security forces seem to have collapsed or melted away. And this is after the U.S. spent tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, training and equipping these forces. What happened? Why was ISIS able to defeat them so quickly?
Jason, I think the defeat that the Iraqi army suffered was not a conventional defeat. It was a result from ammunition or, you know, imbalanced size, as it happens in every conventional war. The Iraqi army was better equipped, was better trained by the Americans.
Sergei, could you speak to why there seems to have been a lack of support for this government? What's happened in Iraq? In its domestic politics to lead to sort of a collapse of support for the government?
Well, we need to roll back a couple of years from now and then take a look at the grievances of the Sunni population. First of all, of course, everyone remembers that after the defeat of Saddam Hussein's government, the Sunni segment of Iraqi population felt somehow sidelined. They felt assaulted. They felt that they were not similarly represented in the government. That led them to boycott the elections at that point. Then they changed their attitude and started more cooperative approach. However, still they do not think that the current government is representing the Sunni part of the Iraqi population. This is point one. Point number two, if you remember at the outcome of the U.S. Military presence in the in Iraq, there was a big question of what is going to happen with those Sunni fighters that the American commanders managed to bring in accord with the Iraqi government, those sons of Iraq. There were clear promises by the Iraqi government to keep funding that movement of the Sunni tribal fighters against Al-Qaeda, who revolted against Al-Qaeda and who helped actually to quell Al-Qaeda's military advances. Now, these guys have been majorly abandoned by the government. We know that they are not receiving their pays. They were not incorporated in the Iraqi structure of security forces in one way or another. So, and then they had to face returning Al-Qaeda after a few months that the government didn't show any interest in supporting them. So the tribes also were reluctant to cooperate with the government that abandoned them.
So if I can just back you up, what you're saying then is that some of these same Sunni militias that fought shoulder to shoulder with U.S. troops during the Sunni Awakening 6 and 7 years ago are now fighting shoulder to shoulder with ISIS.
Some of them certainly do, and the problem here, of course, allegiance of the tribes. And the tribal politics is quite different from the national politics. Tribes are taking care of themselves in their areas where they are. So they have to form alliances or fight invaders according to what they see is their priority to keep their ground, to hold on to their territory and to their tribe. So this is a very hard and tough choice. Some of them also are driven by support that one side or the other side is offering them, meaning tribesmen need to survive. And if the Iraqi government doesn't want to support the tribal structure or the people who are part of the tribe, then the tribe doesn't really feel connected to this government. So this is why about a year and a half ago, roughly, let's say, or 2 years ago, there started to be some sort of protest in the Sunni-dominated territories that were saying that the government does not support them. And the government, as we know, ended up indicating that the ranks of those protesters who staged sit-in demonstrations, large-scale, who were cutting communications, that they were infiltrated by Al-Qaeda and other terrorist elements, as the Iraqi government puts that.
So it sounds like there were many, many political missteps then along the way over the past couple of years.
There is many reasons to believe so.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Today we're talking about the rise of ISIS and the future of Iraq. We're joined by Sergei Danilushkin in Prague, the director of Radio Free Iraq, Mustafa Ajbeli, a journalist based in Dubai who's covering the conflict, and Namo Abdullah, the Washington bureau chief for Kurdish TV station Ruda, who joins us from Kurdistan in Iraq. I want to remind you that you can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website. That's globaljournalist.org. For more Global Journalist content, you can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. I want to turn the conversation now a little bit to the U.S. Role in Iraq. In recent days, we've heard a lot of debate among politicians in the U.S. about who lost Iraq, who is to blame, and what should be done now. Mustafa Ajbeli, what do you make of the mistakes? What were some of the mistakes that the U.S. made, and what can it do going forward to help resolve the current situation?
The United States has a historical responsibility of making sure that Iraq that is united, that was united before the 2003 invasion, stays united as the United States leaves Iraq. So that is the thing. That is the basic principle. Now, the United States definitely has made several mistakes since the handover of power to the Iraqi government. And that is, you know, the United States basically sort of tried to pull itself out of the Iraqi crisis. They were trying to hand over power as fast as possible, to find a way to leave Iraq as fast as possible without ensuring that the transfer of power is done properly in a way that ensures the unity of Iraq. The Maliki government that took over power engaged in a series of exclusionary policies against the Sunni minority. And all those were despite U.S. Continuous U.S. warnings to the reminders to the Maliki government to make sure to integrate the Sunni.
Namu Abdullah, if I could turn the conversation to you, do you share the same viewpoint? Did the U.S. did it disengage too quickly in 2011? The U.S. had been in Iraq for 8 years at that point.
Well, that's certainly a view shared by a lot of people here, especially that you know, the one Stalin Powell stated famously, "You break something, you own it." So let's say George W. Bush broke Iraq. So Obama has owned him. As he said, he should have withdrawn the U.S. forces responsibly, and he said he did. And when we see now the results, Iraq being turned into stress, it doesn't suggest that the withdrawal of the forces more than 2 years ago was quite responsible. And at that time, I remember the chief of staff of the Iraqi army warned that the Iraqi army was not be ready to defend this country until 2020. You can just Google that and find what he said like 2-3 years ago. But nobody listened to him because the Iraqi government was under a lot of pressure from the Iranian government to not sign an immunity pact for the U.S. soldiers in Iraq in order to remain for a few more years, in order to provide more you know, training and more equipment, and in order to clear the country from Al-Qaeda. But on the other hand, there is another view, Jason, that how could the more U.S. troops in Iraq have prevented a defeat like this one? You know, this defeat was caused, as I said, as many people argue here, by the lack of will, not lack of training or lack of enough equipment or things like that. So, you know, the view is quite divided, actually.
Sergey, do you want to weigh in on this question? Would U.S. involvement now, I mean, there's a crisis right now, would it halt the rapid advance of ISIS in Iraq?
Well, there are two issues I think military analysts and politicians are dealing with. First issue is the immediate goals, what you can do with this or that tool on the ground right now, right away, to achieve certain goals. And then there is a strategic, more, I would say, extended in time goal. How do you hold on to your grounds that you managed to take under control? The question is also compatibility of the troops, technicalities. also the ability of the United States to move just enough forces and enough equipment and in a short period of time to do that. I think the military, the U.S. military commanders would not be happy to move just infantry and drop them down on the ground without, you know, all the necessary logistics. On the other hand, it will give Iraqi government, any Iraqi government, because Iraq is now in a period when one government should come after another one, after the parliamentary elections on April 30th. So what kind of signal it will give to the Iraqi government, whatever it is going to be, the Iraqis should understand that taking the issues are under their control is their own fight. In other words, they might not be militarily ready for that, but they need to have a certain political resolution to make it their own fight. So this is another, I think, more a political issue. But then even if they manage with whatever military tools to quell the advancement or the insurgency of all those forces who are now taking the lead, ISIS and the former Baathists now packed in a different package, and other groups. Now, what do you do to hold on the grounds? Because these guys, this is not a military, this is not a regular army. It's not that you combated 100 tanks, tanks are destroyed, and you hold on the ground and your enemy moves away. No, these guys are going to be trying to stay on the ground. They will launch partisan attacks and they will continue their tactics of suicide attacks. So they will continue to be or they will try to continue to be irritants of the security situation. And it is we know that it is very difficult to hold on to your security over days and years, and knowing that those people are there. So this is a many-tier kind of operation that needs to be considered very carefully. Then also the strategy. We know that during the period of U.S. military presence in Iraq, the strategy and tactics has been changed according to whatever commander was there and whatever ideas they could implement on the ground. Certain tasks remain throughout that period, but different people or different groups of commanders had different approaches. At some point, one approach worked, and at some other point, another approach worked. So now they need to come up with a certain approach that is specifically suited to the situation.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're discussing the rise of ISIS and the current conflict in Iraq. We're joined by Sergei Danilushkin in Prague, who's the director of Radio Free Iraq, Mustafa Ajbeli, a journalist based in Dubai, who's covering the conflict, and Namo Abdullah, the Washington bureau chief for Kurdish TV station Ruda, who joins us from Erbil in Kurdistan in Iraq. You can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website. That's globaljournalist.org. For more, you can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, at Global Jurn. Mustafa Ajbeli, I wanted to turn the conversation to you and get your perspective on what appears to be some incipient cooperation between the United States and Iran during the current crisis. What can you tell us about that, and why do these two old nemeses seem to be working together?
Well, I think it's based on the principle of the enemy is my friend. And both Iran and the United States have a shared interest in making sure that Islamic extremists do not take over Iraq. The Sunni Islamic extremists are against Iran, of course, and they are against Israel and are against the American interests in the region and particularly in Iraq. So they both have that shared interest. Now, but how are they going to cooperate? It's not like Iran has its own hardliners who are opposed to the to any sort of cooperation with the United States. And of course, the Obama administration also has a lot of challenges convincing hardliners or
neoconservatives in the United States in Congress about any sort of left cooperation with Iran. So I think if there is to be any sort of cooperation between Iran and America, it's going to be on the intelligence sharing level, on the more stalking level, rather than actually any sort of like open military cooperation. Or so I think that's how it, you know, eventually. It, I mean, the United States and Iran, as a former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, proper said, told I think the previous the CBC this week, not sure if CBC or some other news outlet in the United States, he said that the United States and Iran worked jointly to fight Taliban in Afghanistan, and they could work again to fight ISIS in Iraq, and that they should do that in a way that is very subtle and in a way that doesn't generate some sort of like public outrage, both in Iran and in the United States.
Sergei Danilochkin, I wanted to ask you, 6 months from now, 1 year from now, things, what will things look like in Iraq? What will things look like in Syria?
Well, you know, I don't have a crystal ball to predict exactly, but first of all, the history of Iraq tells us that the previous government has been born in 9 months plus of efforts. So it is, given the conditions on the ground now, it's pretty easy to predict that, you know, just it will be difficult for the Iraqis, first of all, to form a national government. Then, as my colleagues already mentioned, that there is a huge sectarian element and ethno-sectarian element in the situation when the interests of each community and even sub-communities is drifting or are drifting apart. In that case, you have to produce a joint idea that will bring those partners together. So in Syria, it's a slightly different thing, because over there, we while in Iraq, we are looking at a composition of bad guys who are against the government that has been more or less elected by democratic elections, or through the democratic elections. In Syria, it's another thing. It, then also in Syria, just if I may take a step back, for some reason, we're blaming the United States of holding a complex position on supporting different groups in different places, or we just admit that the Iranians are supporting different sides of the conflict in those two countries. But if we look at those groups that we're talking about, the ISIS and other groups, they are also engaging in alliances not absolutely not mirror-like in Syria and in Iraq. So they are they also have a complex position. So what I want to say is the situation is very difficult. The most important part for the Iraqis is to decide whether they want to keep their national unity, for Kurds to define whether they still can live without Iraq, or they need to take some steps to independence. Not that I'm calling on that. It's the basic question that they have to decide to survive. And in Syria, of course, you have the dictator who is now picking up his ground, gaining against the absolutely fragmented opposition. Unless the opposition in Syria, in one way or another, gets together, they would be facing the same fate of the regime attacking them. The other thing is how far they can go in those alliances and how long those alliances will hold. As we see, the ISIS is absolutely resolved to achieve their goals. So they would shed, I would imagine, easily any ally when their interests do not coincide. So it's a difficult task for everyone in Syria. So unfortunately, I don't see dramatic improvement. So I don't see a very bright future in 6 months. I hope that things could be done to improve the current situation to the at least acceptable level where people can survive, when you know, they can launch some sort of a political process that will bring them to some sort of a solution.
That's where we're going to have to leave it. Thank you again for joining us on Global. That's all for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our thanks to our guests, Sergei Danilushkin, Mustafa Ajbeli, and Namo Abdullah. Our executive producer is Casey Morrell, with assistance from Cameron Dodd, Olga Kustaleva, and Caleb O'Brien. Travis McMillan from the Reynolds Journalism Institute is our technical director, and Pat Akers of KBIA is our audio engineer. Join us again next time for another edition of Global Journalist. For Jim Flink, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for listening.
And now, as part of Global Journalist's continuing coverage of press freedom around the world, we take a look at the press freedom situation in Afghanistan. Global Journalist's Batul Hassan has this report.
In Afghanistan, the past 10 years have often been referred to as the decade of freedom of speech. Despite seeing less success in institutionalizing a stable government, the country's press freedom rankings have jumped 24 spots in 12 years. Karen Karlikar, the director of Freedom House's annual Press Freedom Report, says the improvement is encouraging, especially considering the country's political turmoil.
Afghanistan under the Taliban was really, you know, one of the worst in the world in terms of press freedom. There was very little openness at all in terms of, you know, the general level of democracy and the media.
But despite the dramatic improvement, Afghanistan is still ranked in the, quote, not free category. Afghani photojournalist Bharat Ali Batur says as long as the same faces of corruption remain in power, journalists covering issues considered sensitive by the wrong people are still in danger.
If the corruption is not eliminated from the country, if it still goes on and the warlords are still powerful, and then I don't think that there will be much change.
Batur was forced to flee to Australia after publishing a series of photographs documenting the lives of Bacha Bazi, the name of a cultural tradition of young boys dressed as women dancing as entertainment for men.
These journalists are very vulnerable and they can be easily targeted by the powerful people in this society, and they can be kidnapped, they can be killed, they can be harmed by these people. So they are very vulnerable.
Karlikar agrees. She says that when journalists are under threat, they tend to shy away from covering important but touchy issues, like corruption, tribal or ethnic rivalries, and drug activities. Despite the growth of new media outlets after the fall of the Taliban, she says the value of the content that makes it to the public sphere is usually very watered down.
What we do see is sort of a growth in the number of media outlets, but many of them tend to be owned by different factions, and so they really have a very set political agenda, and they're not really reporting fair and balanced news. Now, if someone sort of reads all of the different media sources, they might get a fuller picture of what's going on, but there's a very high level of sort of interference in editorial content by owners.
Karlikar adds that international development aid spurred the rise of press freedom, and it's uncertain what will happen when many programs and trainings are inevitably pulled from Afghanistan's budget.
And what we've seen is a lot of that international support and media development money has really been pulled back. So there was a lot of money being put in, and I think now there are fewer, you know, opportunities. But there definitely is still a need, and I think it's difficult because of the money is being withdrawn.
Karlikar and Batur are hopeful about recent developments, but both continue to recognize the still precarious position of the press in a country where media freedom has yet to enter the national vocabulary. For Global Journalist, I'm Batul Hassan.